Did you know that Ukraine officially declared independence from the Soviet Union in 1991? We'll discuss this and other interesting facts about ethno-political conflict with author and scholar Dr. Greta Uhling on this episode of The Curious Professor. Everyone, I'm Dr. B. Welcome to the Curious Professor podcast, where I take listeners on a journey of discovery to explore the people, places, artifacts, and natural wonders that spark my curiosity. On this episode of the Curious Professor podcast, we'll explore military conflict, international migration, and forced displacement with Dr. Greta Uhling. But first, a trivia question. What was the world's worst nuclear disaster? I'll have the answer for you at the end of this episode. I'm thrilled to have Dr. Greta Uhling on the show today. Greta's scholarship is broadly concerned with international migration and forced displacement. Major projects have examined the experiences of refugees, asylum seekers, and the internally displaced. Her current project explores the subjective experience of military conflict and forced displacement in Ukraine. Based on ethnographic fieldwork, she documents how the military conflict reconfigures social worlds that became the site of a different, everyday kind of war. Prior to teaching in the program on international and comparative studies at the University of Michigan, Greta consulted with a number of international organizations, including the United Nations Higher Commission for Refugees, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and the Watson Institute at Brown University. Greta holds a PhD in cultural anthropology from the University of Michigan. In 2004, she completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the Solomon Asch Center for the Study of Ethnopolitical Conflict at the University of Pennsylvania. Her first book is Beyond Memory, The Deportation and Repatriation of the Crimean Tatars. Her forthcoming book is Everyday War, The Conflict Over Donbass, Ukraine. Welcome to the show, Greta. It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
What is the most unique thing about you?
Gosh, you know, that's a great question. I think that as an anthropologist, the most unique thing about me is that I've worked for the UN Refugee Agency and then returned to an academic position. And I don't know about other disciplines, but in anthropology, at least, it's sort of considered a one-way door when you leave academia to take up some sort of a position with an organization. But for some reason, I was able to both exit and re-enter academia. And I'm really grateful for that opportunity because I think it's really enriched my scholarship.
Your book, Everyday War, provides an accessible lens through which to understand what non-combatant civilians go through in a country at war. Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Sure. So if you mean like the process of creating the book, I was awarded a Fulbright scholarship in 2014 that enabled me to do research in Ukraine over 3 years. And I spoke with hundreds of people, recorded interviews, and it led to the publication of Everyday War.
And can you tell us a little bit about what are some of the unique stories that you may be included in the work?
Yeah, so I think that most books about war and conflict treat personal relationships as a tangent or a backdrop to the real action. And in contrast, my book, Everyday War, delves into those relationships for their significance to the war directly. And what I mean by everyday war is really, you know, what the title refers to is the experiences of civilians that are affected by the war in Ukraine. And what I became very interesting to me was the very conscious and the very creative ways that non-combatants were responding to the military conflict. So one way to think about it might be that the media is doing a good job of bringing us the freshest news. But when it comes to the war in Ukraine, the civilians who live there are so much more than victims and recipients of humanitarian aid. They're also, you know, acting on their own behalf, one another's behalf. And that's really what I try to focus on in the book, is the conscious and creative ways that non-combatants are responding to the military conflict.
And you mentioned that the displacement impacts women, children, and elderly most significantly. Can you provide us a little more background about that?
Sure. I think that, you know, as is very typical in wars and conflicts, when displacement, when there's a war going on, typically men enlist in the military forces or some sort of battalion, perhaps it's an insurgency, and the women are often in the position of caring for their homes, their families, and that was what produced that dynamic in Ukraine. Although we should also say that at this point in time, the Ukrainian military has one of the highest percentages of female soldiers in the world.
And you said that the war in Ukraine has its roots in the occupation of Crimea, which took place in 2014. Can you give us a little more background about maybe the historical perspective for those people who aren't aware of some of that historical background about the war?
Right. So in 2014, Russian forces occupied the Crimean Peninsula in an attempt to annex the territory and return it to Russia. And that operation was successful from the point of view that there was very little opposition. And Crimea was at least, you know, de facto, it began to be incorporated back into Russian Federation. And it's widely felt that the quote unquote success of that operation emboldened the Russian president to further, you know, advance onto Ukrainian territory. And in eastern Ukraine, that followed pretty quickly. Also in 2014, with, you know, the first shots being fired. And really, at that point, you know, that was shortly after the 2013-2014 revolution that Ukraine had experienced. And right over after the revolution, Ukrainians were very divided as to whether they should pursue a European direction or not. And the residents of the eastern part of the country were ambivalent about whether or not they should side with Kiev or think more in terms of their economic relations with Russia, because their region was very dependent on trade with Russia. And so gradually what happened was the people who were in favor of maintaining those trade ties with Russia gained the upper hand. And then through hybrid means of warfare, you know, infiltrating the structures of governance, turning over the police, population transfers, population movements, the use of mercenaries, that conflict escalated, resulted in the claiming of territory. And it was it turned into a pretty static conflict until the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022.
This ties into your first book, which is called Beyond Memory, and it also is centered around Crimea. Can you talk a little bit about what that book is about and tie it into some of the other topics that we've been discussing?
Yeah, so I did actually a couple years of research in Crimea, looking at the displacement or the deportation of particular groups, especially the Crimean Tatars, from Crimea to what was then Soviet Central Asia. and then their repatriation to what was then independent Ukraine. Crimea was part of independent Ukraine. And so I studied how it was that they became willing to really, you know, sacrifice these lives that they had painstakingly built over the course of about 50 years to reestablish their presence on the Crimean Peninsula. And it was a very difficult process because, of course, local authorities objected to their return. It meant that they would be reclaiming territory, homes that they lost. And so I studied the ways in which they accomplished that objective of reclaiming what was really their rightful place on the Crimean Peninsula as one of the Crimea's indigenous peoples.
I found it interesting when I saw an article that was talking about your dissertation, seems to relate to this question of your book, Beyond Memory. And it said that your dissertation asked, why would people give up everything they have and risk their lives to repatriate in their historic homeland? Can you talk a little bit about how that question may or may not have been answered in your dissertation?
You know, a lot of it has to do with the ways in which, even though they were prohibited from talking about Crimea, from talking about their really horrific experience of being deported, they nevertheless recollected their historic homeland within families and friend groups. And that led to a profound attachment among the second and third generations to this idealized homeland in Crimea. And of course, contributing to that profound emotional attachment to the homeland is, you know, based on their identity as an indigenous people, a sense that in a way it is their obligation to be the stewards of that land, to care for that land, the soil, the crops, the fruits. And at the time that they repatriated, of course, that was in the late 1980s, there were also some historic and contextual factors that contributed to a pretty massive repatriation, which was that, of course, the Soviet Union had broken up. The constituent republics were seeking stronger national identities, you know, above that all-Union Soviet identity. And there was a real upheaval of languages and cultures and people at that time that contributed to the impetus to want to be in the land of their ancestors.
A lot of your intellectual curiosity seems to be around Ukraine. Can you tell us a little bit about what sparked your interest in Ukraine and why that seems to be the focus of a lot of your research?
That is a wonderful question. You know, I think that the gateway drug was literature and language. So when I was a college student, I was sort of randomly shopping for courses. I came upon some literature courses in which not only was I introduced to the literatures of Russia and Ukraine, but the languages. And when I heard the languages spoken, I was absolutely smitten. I dropped French and began studying Russian, eventually going to the first place I went was Ukraine. It was actually Western Ukraine, where I was told that it was probably a really bad idea to speak Russian because it was that was 1989 and they were in the midst of a lot of linguistic tensions. And so then I started learning some Ukrainian, and I think most importantly, my, you know, the beauty of anthropology is learning from people's stories and learning experientially. And my experience in Ukraine with Ukrainians really sparked my curiosity in a way that was like almost insatiable, right? I wanted to know more. And I had such wonderful experiences, both listening to their stories, but also, you know, as an anthropologist, you actually live in the culture and are sort of re-socialized into its ways. And so that was really, I think, how I got interested.
And what do you love most about Ukraine?
The people. One of the ways that I might illustrate that is the quality of friendship. And I write about friendship quite a bit, friendships as well as other types of relationships in my book, Everyday War, quite a bit. But for me, at least, and other people might have different experiences, for me, at least, the quality of friendship was very, very high. And that was something that I placed a great deal of value on. So I guess it's not surprising that relationships are a central focus in the book, Everyday War. You've probably heard that phrase, war is hell. And the question that came to me when I began Everyday War, the conflict over Donbas, Ukraine, was, okay, well, if war is hell, what kind of hell is this? And my research showed a new angle on it, right? It was the kind of hell in which you couldn't call your parents anymore because they were on a different political side, or you couldn't just hang out with your friends because there was all of these really difficult and contentious topics that you were divided on, or you couldn't just go home and, you know, cook for your partner because there were these other things tugging on your conscience, like, you know, who's going to cook for the internally displaced people in the shelter that's around the corner. And so I think if anything, that is probably the thread of continuity. And really, like when it comes to, you know, as I describe in Everyday War, a central point here is that in war, relationships are reconfigured. They have to be because priorities are continually shifting and people have to make very consequential choices about things for which there really aren't any, you know, formal rules or formal philosophies to guide them. They have to kind of improvise these ethics of care and ethics of interpersonal relationships.
I was also interested to see that you've explored policy issues and obstacles for undocumented children. I'm a resident of Arizona, and this was of particular interest to me because of our large population of undocumented people here in the state. Can you tell us about some of the things you found with regards to undocumented children?
You know, I started studying irregular migration when I was at the United Nations, looking at the irregular migration that was taking place into Europe at that time. And so after I completed my assignment at the UN, I began working in DC with a nonprofit that was assisting the Department of Health and Human Services to basically place the children that had been smuggled or trafficked and recovered into the United States in homes while they awaited their asylum decision. And I think that there are many, I would like to say, our understanding of that migration is also incomplete, right? It's complex because when we talk about the migration taking place over the southern border, it's people from many different walks of life, leaving their countries for many different reasons, from many different countries. So it's almost impossible to generalize about that. And I don't even want to try to generalize, but I'll just leave you with some interesting thoughts, which is that if you read news media reports about migration, you'll often encounter this word flow, right? There was a flow of migration, or flows are increasing, or the flow is lower this year than it was last. That's a really interesting word that I think comes from our globalization vocabulary and the way we started thinking about globalization way back in the 90s. But from the migrants' perspective, it's not really about flows, because what they experience, right, like experientially, it's more about like waiting and stuckness. From the migrants' perspective, they're either waiting for their claim to be processed, or they're waiting in a shelter, or they're waiting in an internal, in a, you know, some sort of a center. And So I think that that's important, that that's not how it is experienced by the migrants themselves. And then I think another common misconception, maybe less so today, is that I think, you know, many Americans take great pride in this amazing country that we have. I am among them. And yet I also empathize with migrants who do not see in the United States what people who have legal status see, right? Because they encounter so many barriers. They sometimes encounter such a lack of care and basic friendliness from Americans. And you can see this even if you talk to refugees, right? Refugees, especially from different countries in the African continent. Once they become these sort of racialized others for the first time in their lives, they encounter a very different America than might be experienced by the average American.
And you've also done research on partner violence in refugee communities. What can you tell us about that?
Well, yes, that was part of a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation project. And the organization that I was working with, trying to help the various agencies that assisted refugees with this particular issue to better deal with it. And our task was basically to determine, you know, what did the organization think it was doing for these refugees? What was it actually doing? In what areas was it accomplishing its desired objectives? And in what areas was it perhaps in need of recalibration? And what we found was that in refugee and immigrant communities, there's a very different relationship to the partner violence that takes place in homes. The standard model in the United States is that when there's violence in the home between two intimate partners, those partners should probably be separated. One of them should probably either go to a friend's home or perhaps a shelter while this situation is sorted out. Well, you can imagine that for a refugee or a immigrant, the last thing they want to do is be separated from their community and their family, right? Because that's their network. That is their language community, their support network. And so they are less inclined to see that shelter model as an advantage than the American population. So that's the first thing. And then I think the second thing is that communities of color, minority communities, are so yet used to being stigmatized in some way, right? Found lacking in some way, that the refugee communities and the immigrant communities that we worked with were much more receptive about talking about this in terms of a health issue, right? Healthy relationships, than something's wrong with this family or something's wrong with the values in this community. And we gained a lot more traction by approaching it from that particular direction, how to have a more healthy relationship, than the angle of what's wrong with this group, what's wrong with that group, right? Because nobody wants to be told that there's something wrong. They just want to improve the quality of their life. And so that would probably be the second major learning point from that particular project.
And what new projects are you currently working on?
Interesting that you should ask, but I'm looking at some actually humanitarian related projects in Poland and or Ukraine. And I've never been to Poland, but obviously with so many Ukrainian refugees there, I'm very eager to expand and start a new project there.
And is there anything else you'd like to tell us about you or your work?
You know, I think that with regard to the book Everyday War, if your readers are interested in finding out more, they can, you know, find it anywhere books are sold. It's being launched in just a couple days' time. And the everyday war that I describe in this book is something that takes place in contexts where there have been violations of humanitarian law going on. in which, and what I mean by that is in which residential areas have been not just collateral damage, but actually become targets of military aggression. And, you know, given the prevalence of violations of humanitarian law going on around the world, it suggests that everyday war is not actually confined to Ukraine. And readers of this book might find that there's some applicability across geographic areas to things that are happening in Yemen and Sudan and Afghanistan. So I think that the book has both policy implications and application both inside Ukraine and outside of it.
And I will have a link for our listeners to be able to purchase the book in the show notes. And would you like to provide any other website where listeners can find out more about you?
Absolutely. So my Instagram is my name with a period between the first and the last name. So it's Greta.Yuling. I can also be found on Twitter at Yuling, UMichEDU1. We can put that in the notes as well. And then my website is GretaYuling.com.
And I will have a link to that in the show notes as well. It was great to have you in the show, Greta. Thank you so much for taking time to be a guest on the Curious Professor podcast.
Thank you so much.
And now for the answer to this episode's trivia question. What was the world's worst nuclear disaster? The Chernobyl disaster, which occurred in 1986, is considered the worst nuclear accident of all time. The Chernobyl nuclear power plant in northern Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union at the time. It rated a 7, the maximum severity, on the International Nuclear Event Scale. It was one of only two disasters to ever reach that severity. We'll end the show with something punny. Why is borscht so good? It can't be beat. Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Curious Professor podcast. If there's a person, place, artifact, or natural wonder that has sparked your curiosity and you'd like for me to feature it on the show, please let me know. My website is thecuriousprofessorpodcast.com. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe to the Curious Professor podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like to become part of my community of curiosity seekers, be sure to visit my website, thecuriousprofessorpodcast.com, and join Dr. B's Hive. Until next time, always be learning and be curious with Dr. B.